Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Writer Network. My guest today is Ralph Bloomers. He's been working on forest fire and climate issues for about 25 years. His work focuses on communities in Oregon, Washington, and California. He spent thousands of hours in burned landscapes documenting wildlife and forest regeneration. He's a documentary filmmaker, environmental lawyer, and advocate for living with fire on the land. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being in the program.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
So the first question is, what is a fire-dependent forest? And what's the difference between a fire-dependent forest and, for example, the redwood rainforest, which is a rain-dependent forest and fog-dependent forest where I live?
Yeah, you know, it's really fun to take people into a high severity forest, a forest that has been burned at high intensity where all the trees have been killed, because then you can see the plants and the bird life and the other animals that are dependent on that kind of fire. For example, you'll see Clark's nuthatches, and they are dependent on fire along with the whitebark pine, like in high elevations on Mount Hood or other volcanic peaks. The whitebark pine and the western larch and ponderosa pine, they are a number of species that are fire dependent in that they need high severity fire to spread their cones and propagate. And then they are also dependent on other species, like the whitebark is dependent on the Clark's nuthatch to go around, collect all their seeds. They collect tens of thousands of seeds, bury them around, and remember the locations of about a third of those, and, you know, eat them over winter or whatever when they need them. So they stash all these caches, and then they come back and get most of them. But then the ones they don't get become new whitebark pine trees. And that happens at a higher elevation. And, you know, some of those trees, for example, need a lot of sunlight, and that sunlight is only going to come to the forest floor when all the other trees are killed by fire. That's the, you know, the western larch, which is a tree that its needles turn yellow in the fall, and it then it has very thick bark, so it can withstand fire, but it propagates when the rest of the forest has been cleared away because it's shade intolerant. So, you know, there's a lot of tree species that are, there's a lot of animals like woodpeckers, in particular blackback woodpeckers. They kind of key in on burned landscapes because it's like a vast supermarket of, you know, tasty grubs for them. I think the blackback woodpecker is somewhere between, you know, eats somewhere like 30,000 larvae a year, some massive number. And so it's very dependent on a burned and, of course, unlogged landscape. And one of my favorite books, I think actually I recommend it and give it out, you know, a lot. I've given probably away 400, 500 copies of this book. It's called The Charcoal Forest. And it really has wonderful prose. And it describes, you know, the burn forest as this young forest full of potential, full of new life, and, you know, calls it a salad bar. And this is the kinds of things that I've seen, you know, with my cameras. And I have dozens of wildlife cameras throughout Oregon, and some in California and some in Washington state, that I work to monitor what's happening in burn landscapes. But I'll see, you know, pick up black bears eating the tops of fireweed, or the deer eating the lilies, or, you know, a variety of animals sort of enjoying the salad bar, if you will, offered by a severely burned landscape. So, you know, your question saying, you know, rain is to rainforests what fire is to some fire dependent forest is spot on. I mean, that's a good way to think of it. It's a very good metaphor for thinking of how important fire is to certain forest types. It does reset. And so in a sense, it does, you know, kill some things, which some people view as destructive, but really it's more of like a reset. And that's why I use the word regeneration versus recovery. You know, it's a burn landscape is not a alcoholic that has to go into recovery. It is a, you know, it's just a young charcoal forest that nature is going to paint that charcoal canvas green.
So to be fair, I have to admit that I got the metaphor about the rainforest fire is to a fire dependent forest as rain is to a rainforest from you in one of your videos. So
great.
There's another direction I want to take this with the regeneration. But before I do that, I want one more question about fire dependent forest, which is I have lived my entire adult life in the dry West, Colorado, Idaho, Eastern Washington, until I moved here 20 years ago to the rainforest here. But I go 10 miles east and it's a fire dependent forest. But here's a question that I've never actually asked myself even before, which is, are there fire dependent forests all over the world? Are there fire dependent forests in parts of Africa or South America or Australia? Or is this a North American thing?
There are in other parts of the world fire dependent forests. I'm not as deeply knowledgeable about it, but I think that in Australia for sure, there is forests that and ecosystems that are dependent on fire and responsive to fire. I would say that in Europe, not so much, right? And pretty much not at all. And I think that that is what shaped European settlers and settlers as they moved west and their attitudes towards fire, is that they were not used to fire on the land. They viewed it as bad. They viewed it as something that needed to be put out. They criminalized the use of fire by indigenous people as they moved west. And they just, it was not something they were used to. But in other parts of the world, Australia, they are very firewise. There was indigenous and Aboriginal use of fire in Australia. And there, you know, it's very interesting to think about how people in their homes are fire ready. Not only do they, most of them harden their homes if they live in the bush or in forested landscapes. In other words, they prepare their home to reduce the potential that it will ignite in a fire, but they teach people to shelter in place such that when a fire comes, you stay in your house for a couple, 3 minutes. And as the fire passes your house, you emerge, and if there's any spot fires, you put them out versus evacuating and abandoning your house. So they're actually very advanced in that regard in terms of being firewise and fire ready at an individual level, in addition to using a lot of prescribed fire and putting fire back on the ground to reduce the risk of home loss and structure loss. Yeah, there's things we can learn from other parts of the world about how people live with fire, for sure.
So thank you for that. I want to go back to the notion of regeneration and tell a quick story, which is I was talking to a fisheries biologist who works on the Olympic Peninsula on a river with no dams there. And she told me that she absolutely loves the river. And every time there is a major flood on the river, it breaks her heart because it kills lots of deer and lots of trees and lots of fish and salamanders, and there's a lot of death. But also every time that there's a big flood, it fills her with joy because this is how new habitat is created. And so she said it's a phrase that just slapped me in the face, and I have loved it ever since, which is short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. And I think about, I mean, is that accurate for fire too, that it's a short-term loss of the homes of, by which I'm meaning the non-humans at this point, of the homes for the birds and for the insects, short-term habitat loss in exchange for this long-term regeneration? Would you say that that's an accurate thing, or would you disagree with that?
Yes, I think the flooding of a river, you know, floods are to rivers what fire is to many ecosystems. There's some exceptions where, you know, there's a lot of human caused fire starts, and in some landscapes like Southern California chaparral, there's too much fire on the land. But in the Western Cascades, even in our rainforests, where fire, return intervals in terms of how frequently fire visits these landscapes is in much longer time frames. In other words, 150 to 200 years. So we in our little puny human time scales and our human memory, which is, you know, anywhere from, our lived experience, 10, 20, 30, maybe 40, 50 years. We don't see fire visit the wet Western Cascades maybe in our lifetime, and then we do. And then we have, you know, collectively a mourning around the place changing as we know it. Yet there's this paradoxical relationship, of course, because it's very rejuvenating for that landscape, right? And we love these places because they're wild and dynamic, because they were born in disturbance. Like that old growth forest that we know and love was born in disturbance. It was born in fire. And that Columbia River Gorge was born in the Missoula floods and landslides. And, you know, we like it. And it's special and fantastic because the trees are thrown akimbo and everything is, you know, disjointed, and there's old snags and there's all this stuff. So, you know, fire is that same force. And you see people say, oh, it's destroyed, it's changed forever. And no, it's just changing your puny little human timescale. And it's not gone. That landscape is still there. And it's just different. And it's actually, when we can get into wildlife, Derek, what we see is that very few, even in the big, intense fire events, very few animals are killed. And I can explain some reasons why that is. But if you're a tiny little critter, you can crawl into the dirt and rocks, and the temperature doesn't change much, so you can survive. And if you're a bird, well, you can fly away and come back. And even if you're a large mammal, the ground speed of most fires is not greater than what they can run, and they know where to run to water or some other safe place. So even if you have a 30 mile an hour wind, that pretty much equates to a 3 mile an hour fire ground speed in a natural forest. Bears can run faster than 3 miles an hour, as I'm sure you know.
So bears can, you know, amble. So they look at the fire and they go, I think, let's sort of mosey over here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people are like, it's wonderful that people are worried about, you know, how the animals fared in fire and that they care about that. And I think, as much as people don't want their home to burn, they're very, you know, I think collectively people are very connected to the land and a sense of loss around the land and this fear. But those are really rooted in, you know, Bambi, the movie, and Smokey's kind of bogus messages, where his handlers told, you know, had Smokey Bear use fear and the fear of the forest and wildlife being destroyed to try to get people to not be so foolish and careless with human caused fire starts, you know. And so his handlers kind of had him lying to the public to scare them by saying, you know, fire destroys the forest and fire kills all wildlife. I mean, those are two of the three most dominant cultural beliefs of wildfire, is that it destroys the forest and kills all wildlife. Both are untrue. So, you know, thinking of it as in terms of floods being good for rivers and, you know, changing channels and creating pools and distributing large wood and creating habitat for salmon, that's exactly right. I would agree 100% with that that parallel there.
So just another basic question. Let's take an area that burns, that burns frequently, a mm-hmm. high frequency. What would be the, you said that areas on the west side of the Cascades might burn every 120 years. What about somewhere in the Blue Mountains or somewhere in a rain shadow? And let's say it is a not average, but a high frequency burn area. Probably how often does it burn? Did it burn prior to colonization, over the last 500,000 years in a reasonable climate? Because I know from listening to you also that, 1920 to 1970 or whenever was a wet period. So in a normal climate regime, how often would it probably burn on the east side of whatever the mountains are on the east side of the I-5 corridor?
Yeah. Well, let's couple things that to talk about in that. One is what's our climate and weather been? And I'll come back to that. But on the east side of the Cascades, so east of, you know, Mount Jefferson, Mount Hood, Mount Shasta, or even in Northern California in the Sierras, you have some lower elevation dry forest types, you know, with pine trees. And also on the east side, though, let's not forget, you do have some higher elevation, moist, mixed conifer forests, right? Where you get a lot of snow. The snow takes a while to melt off. So there are different forest types. It doesn't just equate to east as dry. However, at the lower elevation, ponderosa pines that are dry forest types that you find, you know, Bend, Sisters, out in eastern Oregon in the Blue Mountains, you might have fire on the regular every 20, 30 years. That could be normal. And you can find an old ponderosa pine tree that has, you know, seen fire 10, 20 times. And that's normal. And ponderosa pines have a technology, if you will, have a capacity to be like, oh, that's just a little scrape when they get burned. Their trunks, their boles, their bark is thick and it has the gaps in it that allow that tree to withstand a lot of fire. And a hot fire, because those gaps diffuse the heat. In fact, what a scientist told me once when I first kind of got hooked on caring about burn landscapes and realizing that they were often maligned so that they could be logged, the scientist told me that the NASA engineers that developed the space shuttle borrowed the ponderosa pine technology, because the tiles on the space shuttle were needed to diffuse heat upon reentry. So they did the same thing, thick tiles with gaps in between, just like ponderosa pine bark. So you can have fire, a lot of fire over, you know, many, many hundreds of years, and that tree is still there. And that could be every 15 to in the dry time.
So yeah, thank you for saying that. And the reason I wanted to ask is to make exactly the point you did that many trees will survive. This is okay. So if, let's say, a tree survives a fire 20 times, okay, in my life, I have broken, I think, 2 bones. So it survived a fire 10 times more often than I did a broken bone. So we can say that its response to a fire might be even less than me going, ow, my hand hurts, you know?
Oh yeah. It's more like just like a kid scraping his knee. I mean, you know, bark scorch is the bark on Western larch, also known as tamarack and ponderosa pine, and even Doug fir, the thick bark species. You can have 10% of the crown left on a ponderosa pine after fire and the bark completely scorched, and the tree still has a very high degree of continuing to live. You can even have all the needles burned off, and ponderosa pines will do this thing called flushing, which I have taken photographs and documented. In other words, they do epicormic sprouting, or they just flush new needles in the spring. And you even see it with hardwoods, which is interesting. Like, so if it's really droughty and really windy and the fire blazes through a forest really, really quickly, then you have very superficial scorching of the bark. You have almost no root damage, right? Because the ground is so dry, you're not going to get cooking of the roots because the ground is not laden with moisture. And I've seen lots of hardwoods, you know, lose all their leaves. But then in the spring, you know, they look woolly because they've resprouted all from the trunk of the tree. So trees, you know, while the Forest Service looks at those trees as either dead or, quote, dying, that dying tree is a live tree that has a high degree chance of living. And they tend to use these tools to overpredict mortality so they can cut them down or say that they're hazardous. And there's all these financial reasons that they do that. But in any event, the trees have the capacity to withstand fire, and then even if they're dead, or fire killed, what's really interesting is that dead tree standing will likely persist as a standing dead tree for a long time. There's some studies that show that those dead trees will stand there for 97% of them will stand there for 25 years and longer. And then in some cases, the tops just break off. And in the temperatures among a burned forest that hasn't been cut, there's all these cool microclimates from the dead trees. They store tons of water and release that water over time. They fall over and they provide a leg up for the new conifers to grow on that, you know, knocked over tree and outcompete the shrubs. That's why, you know, you see nurse logs, and I'm sure, Derek, you know all about nurse logs, but that's how you see the new forest established. So, you know, it's really fantastic to spend time in burned forests. I've really enjoyed it. It's where I preferentially spend my time in burned forests, because I find there's so much more to see than in a climax old growth forest.
So I'm gonna lay out how the next few minutes I would like to go. I'm just going to say something else first, which is first question is, aren't standing dead trees at least as important to as homes and food as standing live trees? That's my first question. I'll wait on the other questions till after that one.
Yes, they are huge sources of food for birds. You know, Smokey the Bear, probably born in a hollow log created by wildfire. They also, you know, I was visiting Opal Creek and Jawbone Flats, which burned last year, and it's quite a hike in now because all the bridges burned up and it's hard to get in there. And I was lucky enough to spend 3 days with a fire ecologist named Boone Kaufman. And Boone was telling me that the temperature in a burned and uncut forest is 20 degrees cooler than in a burned and cut forest. And just the cool microclimates created by the dead trees is really important for the new forest. I mean, 20 degrees Fahrenheit, that is huge. And then also what's interesting is you kind of have these, like, the bigger trees are kind of like the mother trees. They will release their nutrients if they know they're going to die. They'll release their nutrients as they're dying that they have remaining in the tree into the ground for the other trees to try to help them. So, and then the dead trees, you know, first the woodpecker will come along. It will excavate a cavity in the tree and then it will move on. And then there's another bird that doesn't have the ability to excavate a cavity like a mountain bluebird. And then that mountain bluebird will use that cavity. So there's a whole, you know, fire dependent series of birds that need that. And just the nutrient cycling. Now, the other piece is carbon. I mean, it's somewhat reductionist, of course, to look at a forest just in terms of how much carbon it stores. But a lot of people look at a big fire and they go, oh my gosh, huge release of carbon. Well, actually, it's mostly water vapor that you see in the plume. And the scientists that have looked at it, it's 5 to 10% of the carbon on average that goes up in a wildfire. And if you cut that burn forest, you lose another 50% of the carbon. And if you don't, well, most of the carbon is still there, right? In the standing dead trees. And the scientists that have looked at it say within 15, 20, 25 years, maybe 30, that burned forest will lay down or uptake an equivalent amount of carbon so that that burned forest has the same amount of carbon as the adjacent old growth unburned. So it really is really important to keep burned forests intact because they also release and contribute a whole bunch of char and biochar and carbon to the soils. And some studies have shown that fire leads to longer term storage of longer periods of time, greater carbon storage, right? Because they lead to this pulse of dead material, then a new forest grows. And we really have to look at it again, not at one point in time, but over time and what the mass balance is of nutrients and carbon and habitat and homes for wildlife, similar to, you know, we shouldn't just look at the forest as this static thing that we want to enjoy in a particular point in its evolution, but really just that we get to enjoy a diversity of points in time. Kind of a similar way of thinking about it.
Years ago, I was talking to George Werthner, and he was saying he'd been hiking back in the back in Yellowstone somewhere, and he saw multiple grizzlies tearing up rotting logs. That was an especially good year for the ants who live inside the rotting logs. Mm-hmm. And he then made the connection between the Yellowstone fire and these particular logs. So he was saying even 25 years later, the Yellowstone fire was feeding today's grizzlies. And I love that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I have some pretty cool footage of California golden bears ripping open logs in Yellowstone and the Stanislaus around it, searching for grubs. So yeah, it is a buffet. It is a vast supermarket of tasty treats for a burn forest is all these things for a lot of plants and animals, because there's actually a lot more on offer for plants and animals in a severely burned or moderately burned or lightly burned landscape than there is in a climax old.
So in a couple minutes, I want to talk about the difference between a logged and unburned and logged and burned forest. But before we get there, I am so loving your stories and anecdotes and just your knowledge of forests. So I'm wondering if you can, sorry to use such sort of basic language, but if you could wow us with a couple more beautiful stories of something or another, anything in a either in a fire itself or in a post-fire forest. Just a couple of your favorite stories.
Mm. Well, there's, you know, this spot that I love to go to that is just so sublime. And it is 15 years ago it burned in the Dollar Lake fire. It's on the north side of Mount Hood. And for a brief period in time, after the snow melts, the avalanche lilies emerge for about 2 to 3 weeks. And they only are there because this patch of forest burned in high severity. And you can just lay there in the avalanche lilies, and there's thousands and thousands of bumblebees. And you can look up at the silver snags that had already been excavated by the woodpeckers. And you can see mountain bluebirds, which is a really rare thing. And, you know, bluebirds are common, but mountain bluebirds are not. And they are this iridescent blue, and they're in the silver snags. And there's just so much life in what people think is a burned and destroyed forest. And all the trees are, you know, pretty much most of the trees are still standing. And in the same patch, I set up a bunch of wildlife cameras And then I get to go back and I get to go back, you know, later and check my cameras a month later. And I find cougar and bear and herds of elk. And at this one particular spot, I find this lonely bull elk. And, you know, probably he's not really that lonely, but he's probably been pushed out from the herd. And it turned out that it was his favorite place to sleep and scratch the back of his head with his hoof. And I have hours of footage of this bull elk in the exact same location that I would spend, you know, when I'd hike up there and then just spend some time just laying on the ground, looking up and seeing what I could see and hear. And that's just fantastic. I mean, that's one example. The other one I'll just relate on a more human level. That was one of my most favorite times spending time in the Burn Forest was there was all these kids in Cascade Locks, which is a little town in the Columbia River Gorge between Portland and Hood River. And it's on the north side of the gorge. So it's pretty dark and it's somewhat economically depressed. And there's a number of kids there in the elementary school who were evacuated during the fire. And it was big and scary and it was in an east wind. So it, you know, it blew through town, threatened a lot of structures. And the librarian at the school and the headmaster had seen some of the early work that I did on time-lapse and wildlife photography. And they said, hey, we would like you to come to the school and speak with the kids and show them some of your stuff. And so we got to talking and I said, hey, we should take them out into the forest. We should take them on a forest hike. They need to see it. And the teachers said, yes, taking them out in the forest is a metaphor for their own healing and recovery from the fire. We hope that that's what it will be. And I was just so into doing that. And so we gave all the kids a copy of my favorite book, The Charcoal Forest. And we set up this Burn Forest treasure hunt for them where they could identify and try to find certain things like a cavity or a woodpecker or a bug or a tree that was burned but alive. They loved it. And at the end, we asked one of the girls, how was it out here? And she looked at us and she said, it's over. It's over. And this was 2 years later. And so the fire was still very real for her. And what she meant was the fire is over. And it was 2 years after the fire, but her seeing the burned forest being green and full of life again allowed her to heal from the experience of surviving the wildfire. And so I think that to me is very much what a burned forest is. It's like a young kid full of potential and promise and, you know, and ideas and creativity. That's kind of how I see it.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much. Before we go on, I'm going to do something that an interviewer should never do, just like you, I'm sure, know as an attorney should never do, which is I'm going to ask you a question to which I have absolutely no idea how you're going to answer it. But I'm gonna give you a test here. I just want to see. So can you tell a story of, I mean, you've told stories of how it helps various plants. I know from your videos, how it helps fungus, fungi. But we haven't talked about amphibians. Can you talk about a way that a forest fire could help a salamander or frog or newt?
Ah, yeah.
If you do, I'll be even more impressed than I already am.
Ha. So I just took a salamander researcher recently and have started to learn more about that into one of my locations where I have cameras. And a lot of people think, okay, salamander, that's going to be in a creek, right? And you probably know that, Derek, that that's not the only place that you'll find the amphibians. In fact, the fire-killed forests and the trees that fall down provide habitat for a number of species of salamander that are not found in creeks. They're found in higher elevation. They're found on ridgelines or up draws. And they, you know, in the drier period, they go deep into ground, but then they prefer the habitat under the downed logs. So, yeah, there's a number of salamander species that really, really thrive in burned landscapes away from creeks because of the down logs and the amount of, think of that down log as like a really humongous sponge. It fills up with water, as the snow melts or, you know, the spring rains fill it up. And then over the summer, it releases that moisture. So salamanders dig it.
And salamanders, I'm presuming, mainly eat various detritivores, and detritivores are going to be delighted after a fire. So if I'm correct on both of those, then that means it'll be a buffet for the salamanders too.
Totally a buffet for the salamanders, all the little bugs and larvae and everything else that are found in that decaying log that are helping recycle it. And you know, it was a little late because it was a pretty droughty year this year. As we all know, it's a very droughty year, but even in when we went looking for them, we found a few, and I'm still learning the names of them, but we didn't find as many because they just go underground and then they kind of hibernate until the rain comes again. And they usually still emerge like out into May and June, but this summer they were kind of disappearing from sight around mid-May. But I'm looking forward to learning more about them and checking them out. I think that it's fun to see the little things in a burn forest as much as it is to see, you know, the bears and the elk and the cougar, and which are wonderful to see. And I've gotten on one of the cams, I've worked with a wildlife tracker in the Siskiyous, and he's gotten Pacific Fisher, which was amazing. And then we've gotten Sierra Nevada Red Fox. I've gotten a lot of pika. The pika know to dive into the rocks when fire comes, and they've done pretty well. People were a little worried about them, but in the various places I put up cameras in the rocks, I found lots of pika and some problems with them. And they're probably pretty happy and feeding on some of the bugs as well that come along.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and I have a couple main areas left plus whatever else you want to talk about. And the main areas, I'll tell you both of them. One of them is, can you talk about the difference between logged and unlogged post-burn fires? And an example here, you know, I live in Crescent City, and 199 highway goes east, and it burned, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. But it's along a wild and scenic river, and also the local national forest does not really have a timber sale program. So it's been delightful. I mean, it's just, it has been exactly what you're talking about. And then if you go east into Oregon, there was a fire a couple years ago, and I did not know it was going to do this. I went over to Medford, 6 months ago, and it's absolutely hammered. And so anyway, question one, the difference between them. And then question two, before we started recording, we talked a little bit about home safety. And can you talk, I know it's short shrift because we're running out of time, because I love all your other stories, but can you talk about those two? And then also how people can find out more about your work. Those are the three things I want you to cover.
Okay. Well, places that people can go to look where I've created my, contributed my content include Thriving with Fire, which is both on social media and on the web, and Green Oregon. And I've contributed a lot of my wildlife photography, time-lapse photography. And then I'm working on a film called Elemental. It's an hour plus investigative documentary about fire in the West. And we hope that it'll be picked up by some streaming service. And that should be out soon. And that was supported by National Geographic and others. And it's a really comprehensive look at all aspects of fire, focused through the eyes of the top experts out in the landscape and in burn landscapes, showing you the fire ecology. So I'll just get that and put that out there for folks. And you can see a lot of what I'm talking about with your own eyes and come to your own conclusions. But I think the best thing to do is to find a burn landscape near you that hasn't been logged. And so let's get into that. I mean, if it's a burned and unlogged landscape, you're basically looking at a disturbed landscape, right? And if you got a kid or a friend that gets a burn, do you treat them very tenderly? Do you try to make sure the skin doesn't come off and, you know, put some sort of a bandage on it and let it sort of give it some time to heal? Or do you rip the skin off? Well, obviously you don't rip the skin off. And post-fire logging is kind of like ripping the skin off, right? You're removing the vegetation, you're removing the trees, you're churning up the soils, you're increasing the temperature. It's, you know, it's a disturbance on top of a disturbance. And, you know, in a droughty year, if you do post-fire cutting for whatever reason, to remove dead trees because they might fall on a road, or for, you know, commercial purposes, it's disturbance on disturbance. And it's clear from the best available science, from Oregon State University experts, from experts across the world, that it sets back forest regeneration. It's even been shown to increase fire risk, because your most fundamental resource there is the soils, right? The soil profile, how deep it is. And so you're going in there and churning it up. You're eliminating the food for the next forest, which is the dead material. And you're risking, in many cases, desertifying that landscape. I mean, it's more likely that a burned landscape that gets logged is going to be converted into something else, a field of cheatgrass, than a burned landscape that is left alone. A burned landscape that is left alone has got all the seeds in there that are in the ground that were waiting to emerge, that were waiting for that fire to come. And a lot of people think, oh, we need to march in there and replant. Well, if you look at a burned landscape right after it burns, just look up and you'll actually see, yeah, you'll see a lot of brown needles. And if you see brown needles, guess what? There's a lot of brown cones in there. And those cones will fall down and they will seed the next forest. So, and like I said, you know, those trees will fall down and then they'll give a leg up to the seedling over the shrub layer of, you know, 10, 15 feet. That's why sometimes you'll see a new little tree growing on the root wad of a fallen down tree. Or you'll see a big tree that did that many years ago. So, basically, post-fire logging, which is referred to as salvage logging, suggesting you're making something good out of a bad situation, is really not making something good out of a bad situation. It's a tax on ecological recovery. So that's, you know, really be very sensitive to it. Treat it like you would treat a burn friend or your child who got a, you know, burn their hand. And take it easy.
Thank you for that. And you said before we started recording that that fear of the people's fear for their homes is a significant we could either say cause, or we could say excuse, or we could say justification. I'm trying to think of an absolutely value neutral word, a reason that is given. We can say a reason that is given for much of this logging, but that's are other things that people can do. Oh, and also in here, can you give the numbers on what percentage of forest fires are in fact started by humans. Can you give that as well?
About 8 or 9 out of 10, in other words, 80 to 90% of fires are started by people, whether it's a power line ignition or a firework. I think it's about 50% of fire starts are on July 4th or around that holiday. So significant are, you know, because of our love of incendiary devices on Independence Day. And, you know, other things like trailers with a chain dangling and throwing off sparks, or a hot muffler. We're responsible for most of the fire. And in Oregon last year, it looks like of the 1 million acres that burned, that most of those were ignited by power lines during a dry east wind event. So it's huge. Now, in terms of the sort of primary impediment that I see for people living and accepting and learning to live with fire on the land, there's smoke and the fear of home loss, right? And of course, a home, if it burns down, it doesn't grow back, right? It doesn't grow back. So if we can figure out how to make it so that homes don't ignite and that people feel more comfortable that their homes will survive wildfire by covering our vents and cleaning our gutters and limiting those things, then we are going to be much better able to live with fire on the land. So that's a big focus of my work, is home and community safety, so that people don't feel like we have to try to manipulate vast landscapes of vegetation, which really in the extreme events, the drought and wind events, are the ones that, you know, the few fires in the most extreme events are the ones we have to worry about them.
I think in your TED talk, you gave three simple things. I think it was three simple things that people can do. One of them was the 100 feet, which if you could talk about that for a second. One of them was, I don't remember exactly what the thing was that people are supposed to do, but you said there was a fire went through this community in Southern California, and the only people whose houses were destroyed was because they had illegal dog and cat doors. I didn't quite understand that.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people think, okay, the tree is going to catch on fire and that's what's going to ignite my house. But actually, a tree more than 60 feet from your house that catches on fire doesn't generate enough radiant heat to ignite your structure. What really typically ignites structures on fire in the first instance, assuming, you know, that the adjacent structure isn't on fire, but assuming no structures are on fire and a fire is approaching, it's the little embers penetrating into the house. So most houses are vented, right? They have a crawl space or an attic that is vented. And if embers are blown into your crawl space or your attic, there's a lot of material, small, fine material up there that can catch on fire. And so your houses then ignite from the inside out, right? Not because of a flame front moving towards them, but because of the embers. Similarly, if you have a gutter and it's full of debris, or you have, you know, where your roof kind of has, you know, 2 points that meet and you get, you know, you get a 90 degree point in there where you have some litter that's fine material, that's what you start a campfire with. Fine material. That's what you ignite a house with. So if you have fine material in your gutter, that ignites, then your eave ignites, then your house starts to burn. So gutters, venting, and then the third thing, which was a huge factor in a lot of the home loss in Oregon, we like to put bark mulch around our houses for our landscaping. Well, that stuff ignites. And when that ignites, it smolders for a while, and then it ignites your siding. So if you think of it as, what are the things that are going to ignite your house? You don't need a metal roof. If you have an asphalt roof and it doesn't have any litter on there and your gutter is clear, then it's unlikely to ignite. So the example that I gave was from the La Tuna fire in LA, where all homes have to be hardened by code. And you're not allowed to have a cat or a dog door, because that is a pathway for embers to enter your house and ignite it from the inside out. And if your house ignites, then that thing's going to burn at 2,000 to 3,000 degrees, and it's going to be more likely to ignite your neighbor's house, right? It's going to burn way hotter and way longer than any tree is going to burn. So if we can control the primary things that ignite our structures, which is not a tree deep in the forest, then we can limit home loss. And that has been the focus of Dr. Jack Cohen. And there's this amazing built podcast called Built to Burn on 99% Invisible, where he's in there. And there's some other stories that people can read. And you listen to that and you're like, aha, I get this. And what's so wonderful about that is it's so, okay, I don't have to blame the government, or I don't have to blame it on lack of forest management and this notion that humans are in control of nature that is so dominant. It's instead, it's what I can do to my home to prepare. And like, I would just say, like with smoke, you know, we put on a raincoat when we go out in the winter in the rain. When it's fire season, we should have a smoke filter, just like we have a raincoat. And we should just accept that there's going to be some smoke and just be smoke and fire ready. And I think it's an empowering message. And ultimately, it's a message that's going to keep us from doing damage to natural landscapes in the futile effort to try to control fire behavior across, you know, vast.
That would be a wonderful place to end on, but I want to say something about me, which is that I live in a rainforest, as we've mentioned a couple of times, and I have a particularly bad habit of stacking my firewood under an eave against the house. But I live in a rainforest, so I don't think it's a big deal. But if I lived in a fire-dependent forest, that would be really stupid, right?
Yeah, you should, you know, you should build a little woods, a little structure, a little bit away from your house. I mean, you might have a year, right, where it's a dry year and you could have an east wind and you could have an ignition. And I personally don't feel that even the rainforests of Oregon are without risk anymore. If you look at last year's event, we had 1 million acres burn, and that was outside of Eugene in the rainforest, outside of Salem in the rainforest, and not the coastal rainforest, but, you know, what's considered 200-year fire return interval. And we had, you know, a fire outside of Portland in the Clackamas. Every major river drainage west of the Cascades was in wildfire. And so I think, you know, it depends on your tolerance for risk, but it's not that much effort to prepare your structure to be able to deal with wildfire.
Well, the real point is that I don't think I'm the only person on the planet who has stacked firewood against the house. And and so I guess what I'm just saying is it is generically kind of a bad idea. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, totally. It's a bad idea. I mean, there's some really other cool technology, but it depends on, you know, whether the power will still be on or you have gravity fed water or, you know, whatever. But there's in Australia, they have roof sprinklers and gutter misters. And so when they see fire coming, they just flip those on. And I have a friend who's a climate and forest scientist who was in the path of a wildfire last summer. He saw it coming. He went and told his neighbor, hey, get on your roof. And they both irrigated their roofs. In other words, they wetted down their entire structures for 2 hours and then fled. And there was about 2,000 some homes in their community that burned to the ground, and their two houses survived. So controlling the ignitability of your home is totally possible. I mean, you can give your home a 95 to 98% chance of surviving the most, and that's pretty amazing.
So we really are running out of time, but I'm sorry, I just have to ask a couple more things. One of them is, you said in your TED talk, and you've said elsewhere, that we have actually been in a time of fewer fires than if you go back 120 years, that the number of fires we're seeing these days are not out of line. I just want to hit that real quick. And then the final thing would be anything you want to end on, some sort of rousing, wonderful note, like you've already given me a half dozen of them.
Well, you know, it's interesting looking at the statistics, because you see a very clear climate indicator. In other words, weather and drought, right? Climate is weather and drought and other factors over time. And so what you see from the 1900s to the 1940s-ish, roughly that period, anywhere between 30 and 60 million acres burned. Okay. And last few years, we've seen, You know, last 10 years, we've seen anywhere between 6 and 10 million. There's differences. We have houses all over the place. We've altered the condition of our forest to accept fire to some extent in certain places. So it's a different story. But then also, you mentioned this earlier, and it's worth mentioning, is that from 1940 to late 80s, there was a period of cool, wet climate. And that made it look like we were so much better at fighting fire and putting out fire, and gave people the impressions like, well, just put out the fire. But, you know, when you have a 300,000 acre fire like we're having right now in the Bootleg fire in Southern Oregon, and it's now merged with another fire and it jumped to 350,000 acres. There's just no way you have enough wet stuff to put on the red stuff, and you can't fly, you know, and dump water on that and put that out. And what that is showing you is that fire is primarily driven, once there's ignition, by wind and drought. And fire is primarily put out by no wind and rain. And it's not, yes, fuel is a component of fire. Of course, you need fuel to burn, but it's really not the primary driver of the big fires. And then that allows you to go, okay, can we really manipulate vegetation and affect fire behavior over vast landscapes? Probably not, no. So therefore, we need to focus on our homes and not cut the homes down for wildlife. And that's kind of where I've come, is like, you know, I think that Smokey's message, or maybe a new messenger, if there's a new messenger that emerges, is like, take care of your home, don't cut mine down, if I was speaking for the wild.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ralph Bloomers. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.